Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
Miguel.
And today is the 6th of March, 2024. We are recording episode 184 of our podcast today. Me and Miguel were just lamenting canceled games of the week. Games we can't play. I can't run my Coyote's Aegis, my ongoing D&D game, tomorrow. Miguel?
Yeah, I also had a D&D game get postponed by 2 weeks. I'm not playing D&D tomorrow either.
And then also, our ongoing game of Wicked Ones not happening this week.
Yep.
I'll tell you what, though. I did get to run World of Darkness this week for the first time in a few weeks, which, was neat. It's the one where I got a vampire and a mage in Iceland. And things are afoot.
I feel very vindicated in hearing that you did get to run an RPG this week, because this really supports my insisting that running multiple campaigns would be fine for you.
It means you always
get to play a game. One gets canceled, you got another one.
You told me on the podcast that I should stick with this World of Darkness game, and here it is, being one of the games that I get to play this week. The other thing, Saturday morning, I'm going to be, for the first time, playing Cyberpunk Red.
Yes, you were
RPG
telling me about this.
Of Cyberpunk, the Cyberpunk world. And so I'm going to be trying out that. I'm going to be playing a fixer, which to my understanding means that if we have a problem, I can call a guy to deal with it.
So wait,
it's an
you're
interesting
not...
idea.
You're just the in-betweener. You aren't the fixer. When I think of a fixer, I think of like Winston Wolfe from Pulp Fiction. But I guess maybe he's more of a cleaner. I don't know.
Yeah, in this context, a fixer is typically the person who like makes the connections and like gets the jobs for people and things like that.
All right.
It's very interesting to me that this is a class in Cyberpunk. For example, I like fixers exist as I think the same concept in Shadowrun, but you don't play as them. They are like quest givers. But yeah, I'm a guy who makes connections and gets things for people and gets things done. But I am not like a solo, which is what they call like someone who actually, you know, a heavy sort of person.
Well, I look forward to hearing your experience with the system.
Yeah.
Having never played anything Cyberpunk besides the video game, the 2077 video game.
It occurs to me that this is the first episode we've recorded since I got to play Girl by Moonlight, the magical girl game based on Forged in the Dark. Also, I have bought said game because I don't know if you've seen, there's this GM's Day sale going on.
No, wait, what?
It's on like drive-through RPG and stuff. A whole bunch of stuff is on sale. It's like GM's Day or something.
Oh, this is bad. This is bad, Tom.
Why?
Because we just got out of Zine RPG Month, and I totally backed a couple of Zine RPGs, and now here's even more. I don't need more game stuff, but look at all this cool stuff.
Oh, man, you're already into it, aren't you?
I had to look it up to see what you were talking about. And man, look at the most popular under $5. Got a lot of discounts here. Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master.
Yeah, so, I got Girl by Moonlight. My experience of playing it was interesting because it was, I don't know if I mentioned this, but it was part of an event where people were running one-shots. And so it was a one-shot of Girl by Moonlight. But, you know, since it's based on the same system, you can sort of see the dissonance there if you were to run, say, a one-shot of Wicked Ones, right? Like, there's a lot of systems that are built to be ongoing in that, in that game. And similarly, Girl by Moonlight is the same way. And in fairness to the GM, my friend, I think that they did a fantastic job adapting it to the one-shot format, because what they effectively did is they took a lot of the session zero and just filled it out themselves, basically. You know, there's a big portion of the game that is, like, collaboratively creating the series that you're exploring in your game. The GM in this case just filled that out ahead of time, and what we did was create our characters at the head of the game. And I think that it's, it's generally, like, I definitely know how I would run a one-shot of this system. Like, I think it's definitely possible. You basically, I mean, probably the easiest way to do it is just adapt it to be like an episode of Sailor Moon. Yeah, very, very interesting stuff in it. One of the big systems that I may have mentioned before is that when your stress fills up, you eclipse, and it represents like a major sort of dark moment for your character that the rest of your team has to then pull you out of through sort of the power of community and friendship. And I've said this before, but I find Forged in the Dark games thrive on being very specific to the genre or experience that they are trying to present. Mm-hmm. Forged in the Dark, for me, is not a generic system. It is like a hyper-specific system. And this is just a great way that they do that. I was low-key kind of angling to eclipse in this one shot just to, like, explore that going on. But we were a bit pressed for time, and I got pretty close to the wire. But, you know, it's, it was a cool experience. It's, of course, it was also like my first time in ages playing with not necessarily strangers, because all the players ended up being people I'd met before, but just sort of like acquaintances, like not
a new group.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, this is also in my group Lucio runs, who we had on the podcast,
right?
The Cypher game, and that is a game that also, when I joined it, I didn't know people super well, I don't think. We filled out consent forms, which we also did for this one, which was all like, you know, you write green, yellow, or red depending on, like, for a list of topics, depending on, like, whether you're willing to take those on in the game or if you're theoretically allowed to have that, but, like, you know, fade to black, etc. One player at the table, I think that they had lost their sheet that they were going to bring in, and then they said, don't worry, it was all green anyway. Which I think is a funny announcement, but... Anyway,
Tom, how many games are you currently playing or running? Like, how many games are going on in Tom's life currently? Is that Cypher one still ongoing?
It is not going to be back for a long time because Lucio is going to the Philippines.
Oh, wow. Right on.
Yeah. So it's not going to happen for a long time.
And then besides that, you've got World of Darkness, you've got Coyote's Aegis, you've got Wicked Ones.
Yes.
And you will have Cyberpunk.
Yeah. Let's see how this goes.
It's a lot of games. Good times.
Yeah, you know, because the thing is, Lucio does, like, professional, like, runs games for money and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's a site that allows that to happen called Start Playing. I don't know if you've ever heard of or seen this site.
No. There is a site where I can become a GM for hire.
Yes, and you can also, like, buy your way into games as well. It does both. It's like, so there's, like, a, you go there, and there's all, like, there's even, if you look up Wicked Ones, there's, like, a Wicked Ones game that has, like, one slot left. I think it costs, like, $30 per session or something. Yeah. And then it's also, I was looking at, I just got my account yesterday, and I was looking at how you gotta set up your GM, how to be a GM.
Are you gonna do it? You gonna take the plunge?
Maybe. I'm looking at it. I need an appropriate picture of myself.
This is pretty cool.
I mean, I'm
going down the list of professional dungeon masters. Tim the Enchanter. Guy charges $25.
I saw somebody who, someone had left them a bad review, and that, like, kind of scares me. It's like, oh man, that really hurt.
I guess that is the risk, isn't it?
Yeah, really putting yourself out there. I believe in you.
I think this would be an amazing course of action for you, Tom.
I don't know. I feel like I could maybe curb this by, like, not charging a lot of money, but, like, I'm not in the habit. I feel like these people who charge a bunch, they, like, do music and all sorts of stuff, and, like,
it could just also be that they're really in demand. You know, you're in demand, your prices go up.
Maybe. Maybe. Who knows? Speculating about Start Playing here on the podcast. Man, we haven't even got to what this episode is about. We've just been sort of lamenting.
Talking about the RPGs in our lives. But, I mean, that's also what this show is about.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, you know, so one thing that was interesting about Girl by Moonlight is that you have an obligation phase, and in that phase, you basically, you have to roll resistance, and it is, you are resisting just, like, the stress of your obligation, and man, I got snake eyes. I was like, oh no, I had the most stressful day that I could have had, and so I started the game, like, pretty, like, halfway to eclipsing.
And it was fun. You'd play more of it?
Oh, yeah. I love the sort of theoretical stuff that we didn't even get into. That's, like, you know, designing the series and everything like that. Like,
I mean, this sounds like the topic for a future Danger Room. You think we should cover Girl by Moonlight?
I'm down.
Yeah, all right.
One cool rule about it is you start in the second season of your series.
Nice.
So at the beginning, everybody knows each other already. You've had a few adventures and stuff. And if I were going to run it, I would definitely play that up. Like, I would have pictures and names of villains they'd already defeated that I'd be like, there was that time you defeated Destructo Man and Señor Diablo, who you put away for cultural appropriation, and
I love it. I think I've even talked about how I kind of love just launching into it, not having to have the players meet at the beginning. You already know each other, your childhood friends, that kind of thing.
You've already been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
You've got a hideout and everything. Although, man, there are four templates for four different series concepts. The one that we played is the more Sailor Moon sort of one. And that one you have like a hideout. But there's one that where you have a spaceship and nice. It's all like instead of expanding your hideout, you expand the sections of your spaceship. But the one that I think like naturally entices for a lot of people, certainly me included, is the last series template is like based on, I don't know if you know the anime Serial Experiments Lane, but also
I know of it.
But also, like, Paprika is listed as, like, another reference point. And it's all about, like, dreams and conspiracies and all sorts of crazy stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun time. We should definitely look into Girl by Moonlight.
So, in today's episode, meanwhile, I'm just still going with Coyote's Aegis as we've been. We're in the third part of this penultimate operation of the invasion of Agaloch, the liberation of Agaloch. I've got a picture that I included of the map zoomed in on our sort of war zone and the most critical areas of it where they were. You also see a little portrait image that my brother had on Roll 20 at the time. Just sort of poking out in the corner there. So that's what I'm covering is we're starting off the third theater and the third part of the third and final part of this operation.
That's very exciting.
Man, it's a lot, man.
Yeah, man. This has been going on a long time, just this one operation.
Yeah, I definitely felt that way too.
Over on my end of things, we're doing more extreme meat punks forever. We're going to make Tom a character. And we're also going to look at the video game series that is tied into the RPG. I think the video games came first and then the RPG.
Yeah, I believe so.
So I've played, I think it's like five or six episodes. It's a serial, like visual novel. And I played the first three. So I'll talk about my experience with that. And then we'll make you a meat mech.
Did I tell you last time what I was going to name my meat mech?
I don't think you said it on the show. You told me off the air though, right? It's Dangus Mangus.
Dangus Mangus, my true name.
I mean, that would be your true name, wouldn't it?
I just like to yell it. It's a perfect opportunity. That's another thing in Girl by Moonlight. You get to do your transformation. And mine was kind of like... Mine was... So we were, like, empowered by, like... Okay, so there's this evil force called the Hunger. They are being served by, like, a court of gods. And we are empowered by, like, gods that have defected from that main court of gods. And so we got to choose which gods sort of empowered us and like have aspects of them in our transformations and stuff. So my god was Hel from Norse mythology. And when I transformed, I like rose up into the air from like a mass of spirits. And then like a big skeleton came up behind me and sort of like enveloped me in bones that then like hardened into like witchblade style armor.
Whoa.
That would be like my moon crystal power, etc. You know? I don't know if you're that into the magical girl genre.
I mean,
I haven't watched that much.
Into, I don't know about Into, but I've certainly been exposed to plenty of it.
Yeah. So, I guess we'll just start with me as we do.
Yeah, let's see. Here we go. Rounding the end of the op. What happens next?
So, to recap, the assault on the mantle, the capital of the human supremacist kingdom that lies at the heart of the haunted forest Agaloc in the southern Deathlands, has begun. The party has already completed objectives on 2 out of 3 fronts, first joining the spearhead of the Draelic naval assault along the Deathlands' southern coast, then quickly moving inland by aircraft. Then, with the benefit of floating steeds granted by their drow allies, they infiltrated a hidden Underdark passage. Despite attempts at treachery and other obstacles, they have cleared their way through the passage, which should allow them to emerge behind enemy lines to assist their allies assaulting the city by land. Once they join that assault, they must interrogate the demon leading the defenders and take them alive, and they have also been instructed to seek out a high-value drow prisoner named Gak. Intel indicates he is being held in a tower among the defenses. They were told they would be given unique steeds by the drow for this task as well, in the form of giant spiders. So, this is where I showed the map.
Yeah, giant spiders.
This is where I showed the map of all the relevant areas of the mantle and the surrounding area of Agaloc and the coast that were important to this assault. You can see, if you look at that map on our show notes, comparingcampaign.wordpress.com, we've got the area of the naval assault. We've got the area where they sort of landed to get to the Underdark passage. And we see now where they came out in sort of the one level of the mantle. And then you can also see where the land assault is happening, up to the north.
I like how, you've screenshotted this from Roll 20. I like that, one of your player's avatars is down in the corner and it's like a knight looking distressed, like holding his head in his hands. So you've got a little bit of commentary down in the corner of the knight being like, oh man.
Yeah, that was my brother's, I don't know if it still is, but it was it's not anymore because he changed his portrait to Ahmed.
Yeah, it looked like Ahmed in our game of teeth.
But yeah, for a long time he had this guy. I think it's a knight from Dark Souls, Dark Souls, and he's clutching his helmet as if in distress,
looking out over the battlefield, the map of the battlefield, and the various assaults.
So, when we left off, they had just dispatched the demons guarding the Underdark passage leading further into the mantle. They were assisted by a drow scout by the name of Tex. In the fight, they saved the life of another drow that was lying on the floor when they arrived. So, in the aftermath of their battle with the demons, Tex calls out to the female drow that went to take cover behind one of the pillars. She steps out, and Tex explains, "This is Naomi, another of my agents." Naomi bows slightly. Tex turns and addresses the group. They can see that his back is still slightly torn where the fiend clawed him as he took to the air. He says, I owe all of you an apology. I lost my composure earlier, questioning if you were who you claimed. There is no question. You saved my life on the stairs, and now you've saved one of my remaining loyal scouts. I am in your debt. We are in your debt." And Connor laughs and says, "All in a day's work," and slaps him with Cure Wounds, level 1. He gets 12 healing. Tex smiles appreciatively to Connor, then gives an expectant look to Naomi, who straightens. "I was investigating one of our own." Naomi points to the drow that Tex decapitated in midair. "Call it madness if you like, but some of the weaker-willed agents fell under Grat's influence." Naomi's explanation is directed at both the party and Tex. her superior, like a report from a scout given to an officer in the field. Tex replies, yes, we had some trouble with one of them on our own end. Tex looks to the rest of the party, and Naomi simply gives a sharp nod. So, not sure if it's Hex or Connor, but he says, MPOC found that specially treated brain caps can protect against such madness. Perhaps you could get some, just to have on hand. Where to next? It seems we have a bit of time pressure, what with the portals to the abyss and all. That being what they learned in their interrogation of the last demon. Apparently they're opening portals to the abyss in the mantle. And he said that Gratz already walks in their world. So, Tex takes the lead and says, this way. Oh, and let me be the first to say, welcome to the mantle. Tex gestures around the hall. This was once a court for my people. Though it has been made a mockery of, it is good to see justice done here. Tex thinks to himself for a moment before continuing. Unfortunately, the real resistance is on the surface. Follow me. Tex proceeds to head up one of the flights of stairs leading out of the hall, with Naomi following close behind. The party follows after. They follow Tex and Naomi out of the old drow holdings beneath the mantle, climbing decrepit stone stairways through the dark with their trioptics on. The further up they go, the more they hear the sounds of battle above. Finally, they emerge. The mantle is a hellhole of fire and iron. It's familiar enough after Ashgrain Outpost, but they wonder at how this could be the same place where they infiltrated the human's masquerade. Tex gives a quick signal to Naomi, and she hurries over, unfolding a map for everyone to see. The drow indicate their present position in the city, though they understand their fingers pointing at the map better than their voices, which are nearly drowned out by the din of war. Seeing the map helps them get their bearings. They're in the upper northwest corner of the city, on a massive plateau that overlooks the rest of the city. They stand between the drop from that plateau into the city and the city's northwest defenses. Should those defenses fall, their attacking allies will be able to pour down into the city from here. It's a natural spot for the land assault, as military strength can flow into the northwest corner of the mantle from both the newly taken Ashgrain outpost and the neighboring jungles, which are inhabited by orcs and ogres that regularly do battle with the Nightside Eclipse. The party also knows that they'll have allies attacking the city from the southeast corner at the same time, having secured the naval landing. So, this is all reference to the map that is on our show notes. You can sort of see what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's all right there.
The city looks as though it has already seen violent destruction throughout most of its breadth. Houses of the wealthy and powerful that overlook the city from this high vantage have been torn down or torched. However, the city's mighty factories still belch out flame. Less prominent than those that dominated Ashgrain Outpost, but the ones here stand out against the soot-black streets and ruins. The drow lead the party to cover in a nearby building, which gives them some respite from the noise. This place used to be an armory. It was cleared out so they could house our stolen steeds, Naomi explains while Tex takes his sword and scrapes it against a nearby wall three times. They hear a click from a nearby door, and it is opened by a drow who emerges with his dark gun drawn. Tex quickly approaches the drow, who recognizes him and salutes, stepping out of the way to allow his superior entry. Hopefully they're more agreeable than the cloakers, Connor grumbles.
So we're like middle center of the map, right? That armory?
Yeah, we're just at the edge of a line, like where it says exit from the Underdark.
Yeah.
That line is like the drop that overlooks the rest of the city. And so they are like just up in that little slice of the city in the upper corner.
Slice of the city in the upper corner. Hang on. Have I got this right? You were saying they were in a building that was an armory, right?
Yeah.
But that's not the armory indicated top center of this map.
No. That was the armory for Ashgrain Outpost.
Got it. Okay, my mistake.
That's just leftover stuff from the last operation. Sorry, I can see how that'd be confusing, actually.
No worries.
So, they follow Tex into a large warehouse. Large doors, like those of a barn, stand on the other side of the warehouse, and all around are cages containing huge spiders. A few drow tend to the many giant arachnids. We've taken care of them, even in slavery. We have shared the burden of captivity, Tex explains, gesturing around at the spiders and their caretakers. Now you get to repay us, Tex raises his voice as if addressing the spiders now. Let's get them saddled. Alex asks, how many giant spiders are there here? Are the drow gearing up to come with us? I say, you're given your pick of the selection, and there are four different kinds of giant spider on offer. Whichever you choose, you will be given that spider equipped with a saddle and sidecar so that up to two of you can ride it at a time. The drow explain that should the mounts be slain, they can ride new ones out to you in the field, but naturally it will take a moment for them to reach you. The sidecars are primarily provided so that you can pick each other up while awaiting new mounts, so that you aren't left sitting ducks in the interim. This is actually all from the module, Blood Above, Blood Below. There is a sort of trend to each step of the epic, no matter which section you were playing. At some point you got a mount of some kind or a vehicle in the case of the naval combat, and you had like a certain amount of like selection to it and like rules. So in the first one, you have explained to you the rules of your ship, and you get to choose your roles and name your ship and all that stuff. In the second one, you're given the cloaker steed, and in this one, you get the spider steed, and you get to choose which from like a variety of different types of giant spiders.
I feel like the idea of putting a saddle on a giant spider, it's like one of those funny internet memes that you see where it's like, you know, if a dog wore pants, would it look like this or would it look like this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I get it.
Or like maybe a better one that you can picture in your head is if a giraffe wore a bow tie, would the bow tie be up under its chin or would it be down at the base of its neck?
I said I get it the first time.
I just thought, you know, this is an easier one to picture is all. For our listeners, Tom.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Look, I know you're smart. I don't know about them. I'm kidding, everybody.
Man. So, Alex had asked about whether the drow were going to saddle up with them. I say, Tex seems like he could hold his own alongside you in the field, but the other drow aren't in great shape. He hasn't shown any intention of joining the assault with you, but it might be so that he can coordinate the delivery of new mounts in case their initial choices are slain. And Alex says, fair. What differentiates the four types of spider? I'm glad he asked. Each spider type has a specific ability which they gain access to as a mount action on their turn. If a d6 must be rolled to recharge the power, they may roll the d6 each turn. The standard giant spider has a restraining web attack with a range of 30 feet to 60 feet that recharges on a 5 or 6. The spitting spider, the drow have their own names for these different spider species, but give you blunt translations instead. The spitting spider has ranged poison attack with a range of 30, 60 that recharges on a 5 to 6. The thug spider can use the character's reaction to shield them or an ally within 10 feet from an attack, taking half the damage from the attack. Finally, the jumping spider has a long jump of 40 feet and can jump 20 feet high when it has a running start. Again, these are all from Blood Above, Blood Below. So Connor chooses to go with the thug spider. Hex grabs a spitting spider. Gent goes with a jumping one. Also suggests maybe offering Tex money to join them or something. I say, upon your suggestion that he join you, Tex considers a moment. I can assist you, yes, but I might suggest that you reserve my assistance for a critical situation. I am not afraid to give my life in the effort against these tyrants, but I would wish for my death to have meaning if possible. Do you wish for me to join you from the instant of your initial charge, or shall I wait for your call? Alex says, probably get him to wait, right? At the very least, we could charge in and be distracting. We could get him to sneak in and be a hero. Jen says, I agree. I say, it's also up to you if you want him to grab one of the mounts for when the time comes. Alex says, I mean, provided we don't use them all, I think that he should be ready to hop on one. So, Tex on standby, ready to grab a spider if there's one available when they call him in. The doors of the warehouse grind open to reveal a vast street of blackened stone on the other side. Fire giants rave and scream in the distance, and flames gout from a nearby factory. The air reeks of soot and burnt meat. The noise is deafening. Chaos reigns. Connor touches his symbol of Paylor and readies his shotgun. As they approach the defenses from behind enemy lines, they see three platforms with tall metal supports in the trees. Further reinforcements of barbed, crude iron chains lash the platforms together and stretch like webs to the ground. They could probably risk the barbs and climb the chains with some difficulty were they on foot, but with their new mounts, they could cross these chains with ease, ignoring the barbs as though they weren't there. On each platform, a leering fire giant stands ready for combat. An ironclad tower rises between them, with a fiery light blazing from a slatted window at its head. Every few seconds, a beam of fire lances down from the tower to immolate one of the attackers. Fiery chariots thunder forth through the city streets to meet the enemy at the gates. There seem to be loose chains lying everywhere amid the chaos of battle and the tangle of the forest floor outside the city. The trees of Agaloc surrounding the city rise to a height of roughly 80 feet. The platforms are 40 feet up, while the iron tower rises to a height of 60 feet. Red-hot spikes rim the platforms and cover the exterior of the platform, discouraging the attackers from attempting to climb the defenses. Rocks hurled by giants soar from the defenses down into the attackers. Seeing the giants on their defensive platforms, they know that for each giant felled this battle, they will deal a blow that invigorates their own side's morale. Each time a character kills a fire giant, they'll gain advantage on their next roll. The fire giants on each platform confer a unique bonus as well. Every time they kill one of the fire giants atop one of the three platforms, everyone in the party gains advantage on their next roll and the benefit of a short rest on the spot. Their angle of attack is frustrated somewhat by the flame vents blasting out from parts of the streets. It is while maneuvering between these that they spot an imminent threat above them. Two floating orbs clad in steel armor are patrolling the streets. Their singular central eyes blaze with flame, and their jaws burn red hot. Smaller eyeballs sprout from the beasts on writhing stalks.
Beholders!
Fucking Eye of Flame Beholders, I believe they're called. And, you know, I should say, I feel like this section of the operation you actually have experienced in another form. It was the last session that I ran of Ashes Against the Grain where you guys were in like a big gladiatorial fight against a bunch of fire giants.
That's right. And there was like the cages in the middle, right?
Yeah, there was all sorts of stuff going on. There was like chariots and stuff. That was this, man.
Oh, wow.
Except with extra stuff from the whole meat. So
cool. I mean, that just further reinforces something we've talked about. And I believe I've spoken it directly to our listeners about, like, hey, DMs, GMs, it's okay to recycle content and just dress it up differently. Your players will never know. I would never have put that together just listening to you describe this, that you ran it, just, you know, tweaked the variables in a game that I was a player in.
So, the two floating monstrosities let out a metallic cry that echoes through the streets. They start towards the party, and suddenly three rays of flame streak down from the dreaded panopticon at the center of the defenses, one targeting each of the party. Everyone must make a dexterity saving throw. Connor gets a natural one. Alex says, ba-dum-psh. Jed's keen reflexes match with the nimble movements of their mount, allowing them to ignore the beam of blazing heat as they charge. Hex and Connor, however, take 69 fire damage. Connor resists due to his armor, though, taking 34 instead. Nice, but, you know, not nice. We roll initiative. So we have them going up against, they're on their spider mounts, each one on a different type of spider mount. They're going up against two Eye of Flame Beholders, which are like, I'm pretty sure that's what they're called. Beholder, Eye of Flame. Yeah, Eye of Flame. And Eye of Flame was, oh, look at this. It says here on the Forgotten Realms wiki, an Eye of Flame was an unusually docile form of Beholder. While still malevolent, Eyes of Flame were willing to serve beneath more powerful beholders. Anyway.
So Eye of Flame beholders are subservient beholders.
Maybe that's why they're serving a bunch of freaking demons in the mantle.
Ah. Just as an aside, all this talk of Eye of Flame beholders has suddenly made me remember some two Magic the Gathering cards that I tried to build a deck around just because they're ridiculous. The Evil Eye of Urborg and the Evil Eye of Ormsbygor.
So you tried to make your enemies stare into the eyes?
Exactly, but sadly the deck wasn't very viable, and it's just, I don't know, just talking about the Eye of Flame Beholder made me think, oh, and the Evil Eye of Ormsbygor, of course.
So, Gent takes a shot. Their shot pierces into one of the creature's writhing eye stalks. The eye twists to fix them with its weird glare. Gent makes a wisdom save. Suddenly, Gent is overwhelmed with terror. The mighty red orb in its heavy armor seems to loom in the sky like a fiery eclipse. They can hardly bring themselves to look upon its fury. While they can see this creature, they cannot willingly move closer to it, and they have disadvantage on attacks and ability checks. Gent attempts to... Oh, wait. I screwed something up. That's not right. It says here, I fucked something up. Gent shouldn't be frightened.
Oh, you know, it's always tricky, Tom, when you're reading from the transcripts. I can't tell if you are saying it to me or if you are reading what you said in game.
I'm sort of doing both because, like, I hit this point and I'm just like, oh, wait, this is confusing. Oh, it's because I got something wrong. I don't know why. So basically, I tell Gent that they're able to hide. And that it's Hex's turn, but then I say that I fucked something up. Gent shouldn't be frightened. Instead, Connor give me a wisdom save, and Hex give me a dex save. Connor gets a huge wisdom save. Hex does terribly on his dex save, though, and Hex takes 105 fire damage as the beholder that Gent didn't hit tears across him with a ray of blazing fire. And now it's Hex's turn. So Hex makes a spitting attack with his spider. The beholder takes 30 poison damage as the spider's spit splashes through its armor casing into its eye. Hex drinks a healing potion and gets to blasting. I guess I don't really have, like, sections of the monster to light up as being, like, like, they hit the beholder here, I hit them there. It's like I don't have a bipedal hit target or anything. They're just getting hit. They're just hitting these orbs. So
poke them in the eye.
Hex rages, hits them with a bunch of shots. In response, the beholder Hex targeted fires back another ray of fire. Hex takes another 89 damage as the laser of heat of pure heat strikes him directly. Fire damage. Connor makes a dex save as the other beholder targets him. Connor takes 50 fire damage after resistance. The benefit of his cloak of displacement is burned away by the beholder's vicious blast. Suddenly, they see the central eyes of the two beholders glowing with smoldering heat. It feels as if their very gaze is enough to push them to the brink of complete heat exhaustion as they sweep over the party. The two beholders drift downward toward Gent, who has positioned themselves on the mount such that they are not visible, hanging off it bottom of his shape to use it as cover. What the fuck was I talking about? The point is, Jend is like hanging off their mount such that they're not visible. Unable to detect the Kenku, the beholder instead begins to gnashing hungrily at the mount. And Jend says, oh no, I mean, fuck spiders, but I named it Daisy. What was I doing this session? Alex says, can Connor use his reaction to guard Gent's spooter? I say yes, and then I say, oh shit, I fucked up. They can't actually attack this turn, so they drift right above Gent and their mount so that they are both adjacent to Gent and their mount, but they have not yet detected Gent.
That said, sounds Gent... like you're like really sort of distracted and all over the place during this game because you messed up the thing with the... with Gent's fear status, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I must have been having trouble with these beholders or something. Like, it seems like they have legendary actions or something, which maybe I was having trouble tracking how they use them. I said, that said, Gent, you feel like you are in an oven under the gaze of these monsters. Connor commands his spider around behind the beholders and cast Holy Aura so that they have advantage on all saving throws and enemies have disadvantage to attack them. He drinks a Supreme Healing Potion. And then it's Gent Part 2. Gent fires from their hiding space. Unfortunately, rolls only a 14. Connor rolls a strength save with advantage. Gent rolls a wisdom save with advantage. Connor gets a nat 20. Now Gent is affected by fear. Connor, a shower of boulders comes hurtling in his direction, hurled by the giants manning the defenses. Hex takes 26 bludgeoning damage after resistance. On Gent's turn, they attempt to shoot with disadvantage. Or no, they managed to get a critical. It's not with disadvantage. Again, I screwed something up. I don't know what I'm talking about. Man, sometimes I wonder about this transcript, man. Like, what are we doing here?
It's hard to tell when looking back at it for so after so long.
I
What was
mean,
going on? Because a transcript like that, I could easily see it just being a case where somebody kept coming into your room and being like, hey, needing your attention, calling you away. And so you forget things, you come back to the game after, a minute or two, and you're like, ah, what was happening? I can't remember.
okay, well, I at least explained this one and I now understand it. Is that I thought that Gent would have disadvantage, but then I point out that while Gent is afraid to look at the beholder with their blind sense, they're able to fire without looking. And so I allow them to attack and they get a critical. So they manage to do some substantial damage. But man, two beholders is like no small thing. I say, I might suggest a smoke grenade or a flashbang. To perhaps more clearly illustrate, both beholders are covered in eye stalks that are capable of firing out different attack beams. They've shown an ability to fire one of these beams every time one of you acts, but they didn't attack Gent when they were hidden, implying that they need to be able to see their target to make the attack. So Gent drops a smoke grenade, and I say that you engulf the beholders in a cloud of smoke, obscuring them from your view. Now you can still hear them, but their dread visage won't hinder your aim. Connor and his mount have been caught in the smoke as well, but you know Connor has a gift of supernatural sight thanks to Paylor. Gent makes a wisdom save and is no longer afraid. Hex rides his spider towards the beholders, drinks a supreme healing potion. Apparently, I was having some sort of problem with my internet, I guess. Hex opens fire in the smoke. The two beholders move to glide out from their positions in the cloud of smoke, each headed in a different direction. Everyone gets an opportunity attack. Unfortunately, Gent fails to pierce the bulbous armored orb as it drifts by them. Now, Gent is caught in a horrific heat between the two beholders who hold them and their mount in their gaze from either side. They roll a dexterity saving throw with advantage. They feel as though they are dancing on a spit over an open flame as they grip the limber jumping spider for dear life, swinging to and fro to avoid the lancing beams of heat shot forth from both beholders. They make another dex saving throw with advantage, and they've never felt such intense heat, but they won't be a roast, not after all they've been through this far. They roll another dexterity saving throw with advantage. They say, you feel, I say, you feel as though you're going to pass out from heat exhaustion. You're moving more on instinct than anything else now, a hazy dance of avoidance, narrowly escaping the wrath of the beholders that flank you from either side. The heat from their eyes is so intense. Roll a strength saving throw with advantage. They get a 19. I say, holy shit, Gent's making up for all tonight's bad rolls with one insane run. And Gent says, especially since I got a 0 for strength. I say, you feel a beam pass over you, but this one isn't blistering fiery heat. This one is something harder to describe, no doubt magical in nature. Whatever the case, you ignore it, still intent on saving yourself from being cooked by these vile grinning heads. Roll one more dexterity saving throw with advantage. It's the last bolt that hits Gent. Of course it is. They'd been wearing Gent down after all, pushing their defenses to their limit while bearing down on them with all the heat of the two blast furnaces open on either side. Then, in a single instant of blinding white-hot sensation, Gent is struck by a fire ray. It catches them in the shoulder, incinerating their feathers as it touches them. They'd see the fiery lashes whip across Hex and Connor. They knew they'd be hurt. But the glare of the beholders didn't seem to be in full force when they initially attacked their companions. Connor and Hex hadn't been hit while caught in the blistering gaze of the beholder's eyes. Not yet. Gent takes 156 firing damage, suffering
Whoa.
vulnerability due to a cone effect extending 150 feet from the beholder's central eye.
Damn.
Gent uncanny dodges. Good thing. Gent is at 125 HP right now. Connor moves around the smoke grenade to be on Hex's side and blast the beholder with his shotgun. Then summons a spirit weapon to attack the same target. Unfortunately, rattles the armor, but little more. Gent makes another dexterity saving throw with advantage. Another beam passes overhead. They continue to feel the heat of the beholder's stares bearing down on them. Connor makes a strength saving throw with advantage. One of the injured beholder's stalks twists to face Connor and glows eerily. Suddenly, Connor feels his limbs lock into place. Unable to move, Connor is suddenly lifted out of his saddle and pulled through the air into the cloud of smoke, where he disappears from view. Jen is still aware of Connor's presence in the cloud, restrained midair. Preoccupied with the attacking force, the defenders throwing the boulders turn their attention away from the party, but send a single flame skull to reinforce the fire beholder patrol. So Gent fires on one of the,
there's so much like back and forth going on that I'm trying to like summarize here. It's like Gent chooses one of the beholders to attack. But then I point out that I'd let them throw two grenades in one turn using fast hands. And they say they guess they'll do that instead. And I say, knowing what you do about the smoke's effect on the beholder's abilities, it might be worth it to put up a smoke screen on either side. You'll still get to move if you want. The smoke doesn't necessarily save you from the intense heat. You have three smoke grenades remaining. So Gent, I guess, does that. Even though the smoke forces them to breathe through their mask, it's far less stifling than the incredible heat Gent just experienced outside the cloud of smoke. The flame skull glides around the smoke cloud to view Hex on one side, riding his own mount adjacent the mount that Connor was displaced from. The skull rasps, boosh, and suddenly a fireball comes speeding toward the spiders, exploding and catching both Spider and Hex in its blast. Hex rolls the dexterity save with advantage. The spiders have a +7. Hex takes 16 fire damage, avoiding the brunt of the explosion. Hex's mount takes 16 fire damage. Connor's unmounted steed takes the full 32 fire damage without a rider to direct it away from the magical attack. Going by its pure sense of motion, Connor's spider scuttles around the initial cloud of smoke, scurrying away from the blast zone of the Flame Skull's fireball and positioning itself beneath Connor's current position suspended in the air. For Hex's turn, he drinks another supreme healing potion, his last, orders his steed into the smoke, and he lights up his crucifix scimitar, and the reckless attacks begin with a nat 20. Unfortunately, these things are immune to fire, but still, it's right. A nat 20. So he charges into battle. Out of the smoke, Hex can feel the heat of the beholder, the gnashing jaws of fire reaching him, but they miss. Connor falls into his saddle, the power of the beholder no longer holding him in midair, but then he feels the spider wither away under him, screeching as it is torched alive. Connor's mount is slain. Connor must make a dexterity saving throw with advantage. Connor pokes his head out of the smoke. Then he says, never mind. The spirit weapon will attack the injured beholder. I say, ha ha ha, jeez, it's hot. Looks out of smoke cloud, sees beholder. Never mind. Goes back in smoke cloud. Then Connor, after attacking with the spirit weapon, jumps into Gent's sidecar. Connor casts heal on Gent. And then an explosive projectile from the battle hits the ground nearby. Everyone must make a strength save with advantage. Gent must make a dexterity throw with advantage. The trembling of the earth rocks them, but Gent manages to cling to their mount to steady themselves.
However, Hex's mount is also slain by errant fire rays. Hex manages to stay on his feet, though. So now everybody is in clouds of smoke thrown up by Gent's smoke grenades, which are saving them, basically. It's a really good tactic because the beholder's eye rays need to see their targets. And so by throwing up these smoke screens, they manage to stop the beholders from making most of their attacks. The beholders can only really bite now, which is still a dangerous attack, but not nearly as dangerous as the things that their eye rays can do. So Gent can't actually sense very much on their turn because they're in the smoke cloud on their mount, and there are no foes within their blind sense range. They know Connor hopped into the sidecar on their mount and healed them, but that's about it. So they'd be firing blindly at the beholder, and they do pretty nicely for a blind shot. Connor sees the flame skull become blurry, similar to the way that he himself appears thanks to the cloak of displacement. The skull then moves in amongst the clouds of smoke pluming from the grenades. The clouds will likely disperse soon. Hex pops out of the smoke, starts wailing on the beholder recklessly, and gets a nat 20. And Hex performs a brutal beholder execution, leaping up, hacking away its stalks, carving into its central eye, tearing its armor apart like cheap cloth. Without Gent's smoke, you'd probably all be dead. Without Connor's holy aura, you'd probably all be dead. But without Hex, how long would it take before these things were dead? Too long. Hex attacks the Hex then goes over to attack the flame skull and gets another nat 20. I say Hex is feeling the death fury. Hex manages to hit the thing, but miraculously it gets exactly the concentration DC it needed, despite the crit on its blur. Then the other beholder drifts into view behind Hex. Gent detects the beholder hovering past them, granting them an opportunity attack. And they go for the Rapier of Life Stealing. And then it's Connor's turn. Reloads the shotgun. His spirit weapon attacks the beholder. Hex is currently in the heat wave emanating from the remaining beholder's central eye. Hex makes a strength saving throw with advantage. In a battle of wills, Hex refuses to let the telekinetic power of the beholder overtake him. We broke there in the middle of the fight. We begin next time. On Gent's turn, before their turn, a battlefield event will occur. At the end of their turn, the first of the three smoke clouds will dissipate. The other two will clear at the end of Gent's following turn. That's where we broke. Big, big combat.
Yeah, wow. And breaking right in the middle as well.
We did, because, man, it's taken so long to even explain the death of this one beholder.
Did you guys just run out of time, or do you remember why you stopped there?
It was like basically we were hitting 10 o'clock.
Ah, gotcha.
I was like, at the end of this round, we're just going to call it and we'll pick up from next time. So that's how you deal with beholders, though, if you can, is smoke screens. That's what I say. Or any way of, like, trying to block their, like, anything that blocks their sight.
I mean, it sounds so obvious when you say it, but, I mean, now that I think about it, I haven't done a lot of beholder encounters, or either as a player or as a DM, so it wouldn't have occurred to me to, like, throw up, you know, fog cloud or something like that to try and obscure them, but of course. Of course, the thing with all the eyes try to blind it.
Now you know.
It's time to get into some meat punks. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So first, let me just talk about the video games. Let me get my facts straight on these. Heather Flowers, Extreme Meat Punks Forever, a serial game that you can get on itch.io. And yeah, it's 6 episodes. 5 episodes and then the finale. And this is a visual novel that has sort of top-down mech combat sequences. Sort of a top-down brawler. And I don't know. I don't know how to say it. I guess I wasn't totally sold on this one. The visual novel aspect of it is pretty good. I've never been big into the visual novel thing, but good characters, well defined. They all have distinct personalities. The characters certainly the visual novel part where it's like text on screen with character portraits, and you're essentially just like reading the story. That side of it really touched on the anti-fascist and queer aspects of the role-playing game. It has a good, diverse array of characters, you know, people of different races, different genders, and they are talking about how, you know, they all live fairly mundane lives. A couple of them work in a store. Some of them, you know, they take part in community groups at the local church. And all of these characters sort of fall in together at a meeting where one of them is organizing a group of meat punks to take out the fascist element in their town. And then interspersed, and that's sort of as far as I got, is all the characters. You get like little bits of setup about their day-to-day lives, and then they all meet each other at a meeting of meat punks at the local church, all of them driven by the urge to stamp out fascism that is appearing in their community. And where I ended off is after the meeting, they all step outside the church and there's a whole group of fascists there waiting for them. And basically once or twice an episode, I think it's really just like once an episode, there is a mech combat sequence. The playing field for these is always sort of set up kind of like an arena. You know, it'll be like a crowd in a circle and you're fighting in the middle, or it'll be like a group of buildings and you're fighting in the square in the midst of all the buildings. Each meat punk mech has like a basic strike ability and a special ability and then a passive ability. That, you know, basic strike is your leftmost button, special ability is your rightmost button. You control the directions with WASD or the arrow keys, and it's just like, it's really very basic sort of top-down one-on-one combat. And so like the elements are there. Obviously it feels like the characters certainly, and some of those game elements are really reflected in the RPG. But I was actually really disappointed that there isn't a lot of actual, like, meat punk content. The town that they're in with, like, a church and a store, it just feels like a really normal place. And, like, from what we were reading about the world of Extreme Meat Punks Forever, it kind of sounded like it would be a little more flesh-scapey, you know what I mean? Like, they really talked about meat allergy and how they instead of metal, they had meat. But the like trappings of the visual novel just feel like a bunch of normal people And I will say, the character portraits, you never even, at least by episode three, you don't see them in their meat punk mode. You don't see them in their mechs. They're like just people. And then when the mech combat happens, it's just like a little pixely red figure on the screen. It doesn't look like any kind of cool custom meat punk. It doesn't look like any of the mechs from the source book. The world does not appear to have, you know, like, it, even in the source book, in the margins and, like, the page headers, there are these weird, like, fleshy forests and landscapes with all this, like, blood and muscle and nerves poking out of them. Feels like a really, like, alien space. And I just really didn't get any of that off of the video games, which was really disappointing to me. And then another thing that I thought... really, like, it's not like a deal breaker for me, but I felt like they could have put a little bit more time and effort into the backgrounds for the game, because did you have a chance to, like, look at anything to do with it, or just check out the itch page for the video game?
I'd seen some screenshots and stuff, I was looking at screenshots earlier today.
Character art is good, but the backgrounds are all like ASCII art for some reason. I guess because it's sort of cheap and easy to put together. But I don't know, some cool art for the backdrops would have gone a long way. Like, the ASCII art isn't even especially elaborate. It's just sort of like dotted, everything in dotted lines. But I look at like the sort of the menu art, the main menu art for the video game of Extreme Meat Punks Forever, and you've got a pretty sweet looking meat mech here with like a spiky crown and a visor and like teeth around the visor. That looks pretty badass. I have yet to see anything like that in the actual video game of Extreme Meat Punks Forever. So as a game, like what I got from it, okay, it was fine. The decent visual novel, well done characters, wish the artwork was there for the backgrounds, and the fighting is just very sort of clicky, you know, like approach and click, click, click to strike and then back away, like a lot of that. So I get I really got the queer content and the anti-fascist content for sure, but the meat content and the mech content were really lacking, in my opinion. And so that aspect
sounds
of
like
it is
the,
disappointing.
It sounds like the role-playing game set a standard too high, basically.
Maybe, like... but even the menu artwork, the main menu has that wicked picture of a meat mech. So there is the implication that that is there. And like the characters are always talking about getting into their mechs, but it only ever happens in text. You never see them like falling into their mech or anything like that. It's just sort of like they go like, oh, you get into your mech, and then a combat arena begins, and then it stops, and the characters just look like they're human selves, and they're like, whoa, that was intense. There was one part in, I think it was episode two. Episode two is where they go to the meeting. They introduce the four main characters, Brad, Liana, I'm just looking through them here on the Cass, and Sam is the other one. So they introduce the four main characters, and then when a meat mech combat breaks out in episode two, it's like, you're going to take on the fascists in your meat mech. Who do you choose? And I was like, okay, I want to play as Brad. And then the next thing was, Sam being like, no, Brad, I'll handle this. And so you're just forced to play as Sam. And I was like, why even give me the choice? Come on. Like that really bugged me. So I don't know, maybe the RPG set the standard too high for certain elements of it, but all those elements seem like they're supposed to be included. I just didn't get the meat. I didn't get the whole meat of the video game of Extreme Meat Punks Forever. And it's too bad. But I will say, like, playing through the first three episodes, it was brisk. It was not bad. Like, I didn't have a bad time playing the game. All of my disappointment are sort of the things that were promised that weren't included. But judge just based on the fact that it's like an indie game on itch.io, clearly a very small amount of money put behind this, and I guess it's all done by Heather Flowers. Considering all that, like, it's really not bad, but boy, I can already tell you, even without having played the RPG, I really prefer the TTRPG to those video games. You ready to get into the TTRPG?
Yeah, what am I gonna need?
Well, first up, you're gonna need your playbook. And thankfully, when you buy the RPG, it comes with just a PDF of playbooks, and we already know which one you're going to be, right? Unless you've changed your mind since last time.
No.
Tom will be playing the Meat Shifter. Bloop, Sklorch, Lurg. That's you. That's the sound you make. That's the sound you make when your body shifts from pleasing human time normal skin to terrible scorched earth ugly sound meat dermis. A real Jekyll and Hyde situation you got going on here, but which side is worse? Hey, you know what else wasn't in the games? Any of these playbooks. None of the characters really fit into these archetypes. I mean, maybe if I really looked at it, I could be like, oh, I guess that person is this. But like, you know, there certainly wasn't a meat shifter in the part that I played. I guess the Liana is the untethered. She is in a wheelchair, but nothing really indicates that to me besides the fact that I never saw her get in a mech and she's in a wheelchair, similar to the character art on the untethered playbook.
Yeah, even the wheelchair that the untethered is in is like has like bone and intestine in it.
Yeah, it's like sort of souped up. It's a Cronenberg wheelchair for sure. Really didn't get that in the video game at all. Well, so first, Tom, of course, the things that you need to enter into your OC, some of them are already there, like name, pronouns, gender, description. What are you going to call your meat punk?
Oh, man. I don't know, man. I don't have a name.
The nameless.
Off the top of the head.
The unknown.
I have a name for my meat shifter.
You have the name for your mech.
Yeah, sorry. I have a name for my mech, not my meat shifter. Can we come back to this maybe?
Yeah, for sure. I was gonna say the unknown sidebar. You know, so once in a while we mention current events on this show. Did you hear about the Glasgow Willy Wonka experience?
Oh yes, man. Now we're covering, man, this was even on the other CNC podcast, Crate and Crowbar.
I mean, it is worth bringing up because I think this is absolutely hilarious. But yeah, apparently the whole thing was a scam, and all the elements of it were generated by various forms of AI, is what I've heard. The promotional images that made people think there was going to be like a candy-themed Willy Wonka experience that they could run around in were all AI images. And then I've read an interview with the performer who was playing Willy Wonka, and he was saying like the script he got sent was just pages of ChatGPT garbledygook. But the thing that I love, of course, is that the AI apparently randomly inserted into the lore a character called the Unknown. You know all of this, right? You know about the Unknown?
I'm like vaguely aware of it.
The Unknown, yeah. in the lore of the Willy Wonka experience is a rival chocolatier who dresses in long black robes, has long black curly hair and wears a mask that's mirrored, and he hides in the walls and wants to steal Willy Wonka's secrets. So they had a person playing the unknown at the Willy Wonka Experience in that costume who would hide behind a full-length mirror and, like, poke their head out at people. You too could be the unknown, Tom. But as another side note on this, I hear they're making a movie about the Willy Wonka Experience. God.
That's awesome.
Wild.
I love that Oompa Loompa meth lab.
Yeah, the meth lab Oompa Loompa and the unknown. People are saying the perfect 2024 couples costume on Halloween.
Okay, so when I played the game The Outer Worlds on Game Pass for a little while, I had a goofy Flash Gordon-esque name or Buck Rogers type name that I had for my sci-fi man. Maybe I'll just take that one. I'll just be Buzz Bacoyo.
Buzz Bacoyo. That's good. So, your Buzz Bacoyo. Feel free to enter in any other info there that you want. You can see a little blurb on the first page of the playbook about gear. During a mission, you can carry three things on your person anytime you like during the mission. Name one of those things and introduce it to the scene to help you solve a problem. This is a bit like the loadout mechanic from Teeth, where you got to sort of choose what load your character has, and that determines how many items that you can carry. And but the items are undefined until you decide them. In addition, though, you can shift part of your body into meat junk to carry or conceal something small. It takes up space inside you like an organ. If you get hurt, so do the objects, all of them. I think that's pretty interesting. So you can kind of like, you can stash things inside yourself. It's like something out of like Existenz or something. The idea of hiding a device inside a... And
yeah, I'm starting to think this guy's less of a Buzz Bacoyo. Man, I don't
like a blurf Bacoyo.
Oh boy.
So that's just sort of like that's the starting blurb. You can see on the first playbook. I'm guessing these are designed to be folded over, right? Like you have two pages on your playbook. You print them out and then you fold it in half on the vertical axis. I think that's how it's supposed to be viewed. Because then you've...
So my loves are on the left side of the meat shifter.
Yeah, but if you had printed this off, that would be the back of your little book pamphlet, right?
Right.
And then inside are your stats, conditions, mech stats, and moves, which makes a bit more sense. So the first page is your meat shifter with name, pronouns, gender, description. Then you open up the little booklet. Inside are stats, conditions, mech stats, moves. And then on the back page, improvement and love. So we'll sort of go on the intended way, because improvement and love kind of come later in the process. So you've got your introductory stuff like your name. You've got the little blurb about gear. And then it's on to stats. So your stats are attention, chill, awkward, and guts, and instead of like a singular number, you just have modifiers. The range is -2 to +3, and I feel like we did touch on what the stats are. Do you need a little refresher as to each of their purpose, Tom?
I could definitely use one.
All right, so attention represents your perception and alertness and capacity to notice things. You roll it when you make the moves figure shit out or get organized. And there are some playbook moves that it applies to as well. Chill represents your ability to keep calm, focused, and not freak out and stay mentally present. You roll that when you try to get shit done. Awkward represents how you interact with other people, usually in tense situations, and how comforting, tactful, and present you can be around others, and you roll that when you try to have it out, back scratch, or receive emotional healing. And then guts represents your outward physical capabilities, strength, energy, and means of violence. You roll that when you fuck around and find out or receive physical healing, and all of these have the caveat that some playbook moves will also apply. The game encourages you to sort of read over your playbook to see what you're likely to be rolling the most, and then you can choose how your stats stack up accordingly. You have four numbers that you assign among the stats. One stat will be 0, one will be -1, one will be +1, and one will be +2.
I'm going to go +2 chill, +1 awkward, 0 guts, -1 attention.
Okay. And did you read over your playbook? Like, are you doing this strategically, or are you doing this more based on how your character is going to behave? The only one I can see that actually really applies at a glance is maybe if you take the special move Shattered Bleeding But Goddamn It Alive, which applies to guts.
And I don't think I am.
All right. Oh, yeah, and then, okay, but that's Sinew, fine. Okay, so we've assigned the stats. Stats can increase later. They never go above +3 or -2. So the scale that's on your sheet is the max and the absolute minimum, the top and bottom. On the back page, let's talk a bit about love, since that's what they cover next. Love is a representation of the relationship you have with another character, always a fellow player, another OC. Instead of one love stat, you'll have one with each other player representing your end of that joint relationship. The other player will also have a love stat for your relationship. So this is an in-game way of just establishing repartee between everybody within the playing party. A higher number means the relationship is positive, but not necessarily perfect. A lower number means the relationship is not great, but it may have its bright spots. Complex and nuance exist in all relationships. Use this as a general guideline. And the way this works is when you have it out with a player, get up in their business, or use a certain playbook move, you roll that. Unlike the other four stats, love will fluctuate over time as the relationship evolves and is tied to the character's moods. Take it to the next level and drift apart are the moves that may change your love, and love can go all the way down to -3. So I think it's cool just having a mechanic that really pertains to the other players. Like, it's something that I'm trying to figure out how to incorporate something similar into the RPG that I'm building, because I like the idea of there being greater incentive for players to interact with each other rather than just the act of role-playing. Like, I think it's a good idea to have a mechanic that pertains to that as well. I mentioned gear already, how you can carry up to 3 things, and you got your cool meat junk to carry items inside yourself. Gear resets to its original number listed on your playbook sheet after you've gotten some rest. Each character has a special set of moves that only they can do, in addition to the basic moves and mech moves. And it says here, you have to take your Sinew move, and I'm a Creep by default. They're already marked off on your playbook. And then you choose one more. So I'll just read out the two moves that the Meat Shifter starts with. I'm a Creep means that your body can shift into something meat-like and grotesque. Describe the vaguely humanoid form you take to everyone else. You can shift into it at will, but choose one. When you do, you take a status. When you do, for a few minutes, you're not in control. The GM decides what you do until your brain catches up.
That's what I'm going to take.
That's the one you're going to take, is out of control. Tom, you've been on a real real out of control kick lately. You wanted to go nuts in Girl by Moonlight as well. The other options.
It wasn't really going nuts in that case. It's more like entering my dark phase.
Fair. The other two options here are when you do regular human activities are difficult to do, when you do something that requires care, skill, or dexterity, roll with disadvantage. Final option is when you shift, your body is lethal somehow. Whenever the GM makes a hard move against you, their first choice should be that you hurt or destroy. And then the other move you start with automatically is sinew. When you burble and morph into your towering meat form, say your mech's name and roll plus sinew. On a 10+, name one NPC who's afraid. You can kill them for free. On a 7 to 9, name an NPC who's afraid. Ask the GM if they run away. So they really do go hand in hand. You know, I'm a creep. Your body can shift into something meat-like and grotesque. And then in your case, after you do that, you're not in control and the GM takes control for a little bit. And then when you do that, when you burble and morph into your meat form, you roll on sinew, or you roll plus sinew, and on a 10 or more, you can kill an NPC for free, and on a 7 to 9, you can scare an NPC to the point where they might run away.
I'm confused. Because it says, like, your sinew move is when you enter your mech. Your sinew move is always your mech activation move.
Yeah.
Is that the same as my body shifting ability?
Oh, no. You know what? I think you're right. I think they are separate. The language is a bit muddy here, where it says, you know, I'm a creep says your body can shift into something meat-like and grotesque, but sinew is when you morph into your meat form. So I guess there is a distinction. Maybe there's too much meat here too much meat language, talking about the meat form versus your meat-like form. But yeah, I think you're right. I think those are actually two separate ideas, because sinew seems to only pertain to the mech. Interesting, though. So you can meat shift into just a weird meat person, or you can meat shift into your meat mech and then engage in a meat cute. You get one more move, though. Your options are shattered, bleeding, but goddamn it alive, a purposeful grimace and a terrible sound, eternal nausea, or kiss breath turpentine.
Going with eternal nausea.
So you are just as skilled in your human form as your changed form in one particular way. Describe what it is. When you do that thing, you roll with advantage. Well, what are you skilled in?
I don't know.
You don't know. You got to choose. That's what that is.
Do I have to? So what are my options? Just anything?
It seems like anything, though. It says when you do that thing, roll with advantage. So I guess the idea is that you choose something that you anticipate pertaining to something like your stats or maybe your mech. I guess it would just be your stats, because it's you're in your human form and then your changed form.
I guess I should have thought more about this. Let's say lockpicking.
All right. So you can, when you're in your changed form, you're good at lockpicking. I like the idea there. Like maybe you can change your fingers into long nerve-like tendrils that you can slip into locks and pick them in your strange shifted
bone
shape.
Bone spurs.
Yeah, but you get bone picks for sure. I think really what you have been thinking about more than the character is the mech, right?
I mean, I just want it to be called Dangus Mangus.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can do this. Dangus Mangus can live. So let's just let's build a mech on your sheet there. You have the stats for your mech, corpus, sinew, nerve, and viscera. And here's what they do. Corpus is the body, frame, stability, hardiness. Sinew is the mech's connection with the pilot and influenced by emotions. Nerve is the mech's abilities, powers, and interactivity with the world. And viscera is like their constitution, their health, their guts, life. And then corpus, it says your corpus dictates how well you move, operate, function, and stay good on a more mechanical level. Sinew is how close you and your mech are. The better the sinew, the less likely things are to go fuck-shaped. Sinew fluctuates over play. Nerve is an overall stat that dictates how well the mech interacts with everything. And viscera dictates your health and how much damage you can withstand. And so, similar to how you chose your stats, the mech stats, you get a +2, a +1, a +1, and a -1. 2 +1s.
I take +2 and sinew, definitely, because it's like one of the only things I have a like an ability yep. attached to. +1 nerve, +1 viscera, -1 corpus.
Right on. Now let's see here. It says describe your mech. For each stat, pick options from the lists below to customize your mech further. If a stat has a +2 in it, it gets to pick 3 options. If it has a +1, it gets to pick 2 options. If it has -1, it only gets to pick 1 option. Do you have the source book in front of you? You can see these lists for corpus, nerve, sinew, and viscera.
I can get it.
Yeah, grab it. You're looking at page 48.
Not on the PDF, I'm not. Here we go. Corpus. So I'm at -1 for corpus, so I just pick 1?
Yeah.
Red.
Got a red corpus.
What is my corpus? The frame?
Yeah.
Red frame. Nerve, I've got +1, so that's 2 of them?
That's right.
Tiny protracted nerves.
All right.
What does the nerves represent?
What do they represent? Like you're asking me?
Yeah, like you said corpus is like the frame.
Nerves are like, it says like interactivity with the world. So I guess it's okay, sort of like cool. Your dexterity protracted, to a degree.
Protracted tiny digits. Tick, 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 tick. Yeah, sinew, I have +2, and so I get 3 for this one.
Yep.
Painless, massive, inner monologue.
I like that. So, yeah, you and your mech talks to you in your mind?
I mean, what is sinew?
Sinew... It's
the connection yeah. between me and my mech?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, man, painless, massive inner monologue. Maybe it's like I have this, like, I'm perfectly attuned to this insane, like, cacophony that it, like, projects into my mind.
I like it. And then, yeah, viscera.
And what is viscera?
Viscera is, like, your health. It's like the constitution.
And it's 2 things for this one?
Yeah, you have a +1 in that, so that's 2 things.
Scabbed gurgling.
Scabbed and gurgling. Gross. And then you pick your options. This looks like a big one. With many, many lists that you'll actually have to take a look over. And I noticed that we're starting to run a bit long. So do we want to continue this on our next one? And maybe in between recordings, you can take a look at the many different options for your Mac?
Yeah, and I'll think about maybe having more of a concept for my character, because I don't know about Buzz Bacoyo or any of that.
All right.
I feel good about my choices for certain things, but, like, when it comes to the stuff that I was supposed to randomly, like sort of come up with from scratch, like my name and stuff, I'm less settled on that.
All right.
And my skill. The stuff that it listed for me to just pick from, that was easy. The stuff that it didn't, that was hard.
So consider the details of your character. Consider your options that you will be choosing for your mech from the many different lists. There's a long list for each of those mech stats. And they're all just like upgrades and variables and things, and similar to what we just did with the descriptors for your mech, depending on what bonuses or penalties you have in the stat, you'll choose different numbers of options for those too. And I'd also encourage you to look ahead all the way down to like page 54, where it also asks you to choose some weapons. I know you enjoy choosing some weapons.
Yeah, there's not a lot of options.
I guess not, but I imagine there's probably the option to create more. Yeah, I'm supposed
to be able to make up my own.
Yeah. Yeah, it says you can make up your own cool, gross, meaty thing. So put some thought into what kind of weaponry you want. Dangus Mangus, your red mech to have.
Yeah.
We'll pick that up again next time.
So, that's the end of the episode?
Yeah.
Well, if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or just follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Who's sure about what their character is going to be? Not me.
Level up, get that meat. The whole meat. And nothing but the meat.
Yeah. Meat, meat, meat. Meat, meat, meat.